I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, it's Google's world. We just live in it. So why are so many employees leaving it? But first, the American Bar Association is calling for a nationwide moratorium on the death penalty after a three-year study of capital punishment in eight states found numerous flaws. The ABA study cites particular problems in five states, Indiana, Georgia, Ohio, Alabama, and Tennessee, and says executions should be halted in those states immediately. The other states studied, Arizona, Florida, Pennsylvania, the ABA found their death penalty systems not as flawed. Reporter Maurice Posley is with the Chicago Tribune. Maurice, tell us first, what specific problems did the ABA find in its study?
They found largely inequities between states. It's not a level playing field. Failure to videotape interrogations. The preservation of evidence, such as DNA evidence, different rules in different states. In some, there's just no place, no rules to save it at all. Failure to institute best practices on eyewitness identification. Racial disparities. A number of things that vary from state to state.
Jury instructions often poorly written, poorly conveyed. Lawyers often representing people with mental retardation or mental illness don't fully appreciate the significance of their clients' mental disabilities. The list does go on. But there have been critics of the study. We should get right to that. Why is that?
There will be critics from supporters of the death penalty who will say, for instance, Josh Marquis, who's an outspoken supporter of the death penalty, who will basically say this is ABA is basically against the death penalty, and they're doing this to try to get it abolished. Well, the ABA's position is, you know, we take no position on it. We just want a system that's fair and equal.
You mentioned Joshua Marquis. He's the district attorney in Catsup County, Oregon, vice president of the National District Attorneys Association.
Right. And he is one who frequently is supportive of the death penalty and who will say it's really, you know, not that bad.
Well, what about the timing of this study? How might it affect current cases? We know the U.S. Supreme Court is going to consider a case brought by two inmates in Kentucky that contend that lethal injection violates the Eighth Amendment ban on cruel and unusual punishment.
The issue of cruel and unusual punishment in terms of lethal injection is definitely up, and some states have already stopped or put their executions on hold, waiting for this sort of decision. But the idea of whether the system can be trusted to convict the right people is different from the method by which we kill people.
And how might it affect the estimated 3,500 inmates awaiting executions across the country?
My opinion, as someone who sort of follows this issue, is that in the not-too-distant future, we're going to be back to where we were prior to when it was abolished in the 70s. Is this a system that from state to state is the same? Are you going to get the same treatment whether you're in Indiana or Illinois or Georgia or Pennsylvania or California? And if it's different, is that fair?
And finally, Maurice, Illinois, where you are, already has a moratorium on the death penalty. Can you remind us why?
Back in the beginning of 2000, following reports in the Tribune that analyzed all the death penalty cases in Illinois and found serious problems in a number of these same areas, as well as the release of, I think, the 11th person from death row. At the time, we had executed 10, and we were now releasing the 11th person. Governor George Ryan imposed a moratorium, and 3 years later, he actually commuted everyone's sentence because the legislature had declined to enact changes.
And we understand from your writing that since then, what has happened to some of those recommendations?
A number of those recommendations have since been enacted. There is now a death penalty sort of litigation board that puts money aside for defense lawyers. There's a requirement in terms of you have to have some experience before you can defend capital cases. You can't just be, you know, somebody's divorce lawyer or their real estate lawyer. We have videotaping of interrogations in murder cases.
But still, no death penalty in Illinois.
People are still being sentenced to death. There is a moratorium on executions.
No. Maurice Posley, reporter for the Chicago Tribune, speaking to us about the American Bar Association's recommendations today for a nationwide moratorium on the death penalty. Maurice, thank you.
Thank you.
You know you've made it when you are both a noun and a verb and an episode on The Simpsons. Who can forget when Marge Googled herself?
629,000 results. Wow. And all this time I thought Googling yourself meant the other thing.
Marge also Googled a satellite view of her house and then zoomed in to see her naked husband, Homer, sunbathing on the hammock.
Everyone can see you. Get inside.
Never!
Just put on a towel.
Why don't I just put on a dress?
Homer, you've met my parents.
Not naked, I haven't.
Well, of course, the Google satellite shots are not in real time, but point taken, the search engine Google is everywhere. Need street directions? Google them. See pictures of your friends? Google them. Use an email service, store your itinerary, search for videos. Google, Google, Google. And now comes news that the Internet innovator is heading in two new directions, partnering with the Nielsen Company, the television rating system, to let advertisers know how many times their commercials are watched on TV. And Google is also preparing a multi-million-dollar bid for the entire spectrum of UHF television frequencies. If they win, it could ultimately change the way we all use cell phones. But not all is good in Google world. YouTube, which is owned by Google, is being sued by Viacom for copyright infringement for posting content without permission. The company continues to face other copyright lawsuits from newspaper and book publishers, as well as charges of trade violations from other companies. Will the Google bubble burst, or is Google headed for world domination? And anyway, how do they make their money? Eleanor Mills is a Google specialist for the CNET News Service. She joins us from the CNET studios in San Francisco. Eleanor, welcome.
Hello.
And we should say right at the outset, you are the same Eleanor Mills who had a run-in with Google, right? In 2005, you wrote an article about the CEO, Eric Schmidt, using Google, and he was not happy.
That's correct.
What happened? What did you find, and what was their response?
The story had to do with the privacy implications of their technology and the fact that they're making all this information accessible and allowing anyone to see it and get it on the internet. So basically, I used the Google search engine to get some information about Eric Schmidt, who's the CEO, and I think they thought that was a little bit too much of a privacy invasion.
Really? And what was some of the information? Because we've all Googled other people or ourselves. I mean, what was the information that you got?
I didn't include the information necessarily. I linked to where it was publicly accessible on the internet. Things like stock sales, the fact that he held a fundraiser at his house for Al Gore, that he flies a plane, that he's been to Burning Man, things like that.
And people were very critical of Google, that they were critical of you. They said that their employees couldn't talk to you for a while because, you know, the company claims to do no harm and also has been sort of ironically calling for an international privacy standard.
Yes, there's quite a lot going on the privacy front. Google and the other search engines have been trying to have a race on who can be the most privacy protective on their search engines as far as retaining data. Privacy advocates say that if they store the data for so long, then that puts it at risk of being subpoenaed by government officials. So they've been sort of tightening up their rules and trying to one-up each other, Yahoo, Microsoft, Google.
We know last month the Google lawyer called for this international standard, but people were critical of what Google was calling for, saying that they would only categorize as a problem information that caused a person actual harm.
That is correct. The standard that they're proposing would be that a harm has to be proven to a consumer.
And of course, one person's definition of harm might just be that, well, like the CEO, they just didn't want their private information given out, you know, but that's going to be a pretty debatable point.
Yeah, harm is subjective. Yeah. And just the fact that the data is out there without the knowledge of the consumer, knowing that it's accessible, I mean, you could argue that that's harm there, too, if they don't even know.
Right. Google has also been criticized for bowing to China's demands that they block information in China. So, in other words, if you Google, I think it's Tiananmen Square, you will see some information outside of China that you won't see in China. So Google self-censored for China.
They've been criticized for that. Yahoo has gotten a lot of criticism for that because they've actually provided information to the Chinese government that led to the arrest and conviction and 10-year jail sentence to at least one political dissident. Google executives have argued that providing any access and at least letting the Chinese citizens know that there are documents that they can't access, that they're getting a censored version of the web is better than offering them the full web and having the government shut it down and make it inaccessible so they can't even get documents that they should be able to get to.
So there's all sorts of transparency and security issues, but you mentioned Yahoo. Let's talk about the technology. What does Google have that, let's say, Yahoo doesn't have? We read in one article that a top engineer at Google talks about something called a cloud of computing power. It's this sort of like cloud that seems to drift around the world. What is it? It's very secretive, but what is it that Google has?
Well, Google has an amazing infrastructure, and they're not talking about that so much, but they've got data centers and databases and their home-brewed cocktail for storing all of this data and making it searchable. Google is branching out into other businesses. Their mantra now, the Holy Trinity now, as Eric Schmidt puts it, is search, apps, as in web applications, and ads. So the cloud refers to the applications, you know, the Google Apps part of their business, one third of it. And basically what they're trying to do is allow the productivity applications, email and Word and spreadsheets that we're accessing now through Microsoft on our desktop, giving those free versions, often free versions, and you can access them from any browser, any computer, anytime.
Well, let's take a look at some of this. So we have all these applications and all these things that Google is offering for free, and that goes to the advertising because that's how they pay for everything. That's how they're able to offer things for free. How did Google change internet advertising?
Oh, they made search advertising incredibly lucrative, you know, billion-dollar business.
What do you mean search advertising?
The ads that come up when you go into the search engine and you type in a word, the ads that are next to that. So if I typed, you know, tennis shoes, I might get, you know, Nike ad next to that. They realized that when you're searching for something, there's a high likelihood that you're going to either want more information, maybe even buy something. You know, there's an engagement there.
To the extent that we read that Google has something like 64% of the search market, but more important, people spend something like 73% of their advertising budgets on Google because Google seems to somehow get people to buy more of the things that are advertised on Google.
They say that their relevancy is just so spot on that they are offering more relevant ads. That's what they're claiming is giving them their power.
So they're incredibly dominant in that way. And they're making, it's only, what, 50 cents a click when somebody clicks on to search. But that 50 cents adds up because they have so much of the market.
Right. Some search words, keywords, can be anywhere from a few cents to several dollars to even much more, depending on if it's a high-end pharmaceutical, the pharmaceutical company is willing to pay a lot to get that customer. It's a range. And yes, you're right. There's millions of clicks on these a day. So that adds up.
That's reporter Eleanor Mills, who covers Google for CNET News Service. When we come back, what is DoubleClick and why does Google want it so badly? And don't forget, later in the program, after 18 years of trying, ExxonMobil will finally get to take its case before the Supreme Court. Exxon says it shouldn't have to pay billions for the Valdez oil spill, but the company may get an interesting legal surprise. Leonard Nimoy also will join us. He's going to turn his camera on obese women. That's still to come. Back with Eleanor in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more from Eleanor Mills, a Google specialist for the CNET News Service in San Francisco. Google has cornered the market in cyber advertising with its innovative pay-per-click, where advertisers pay Google only when a consumer clicks on the advertiser's link. But now Google is turning its sights on new ways to make money. And Eleanor, we know that Google is trying to buy something called DoubleClick, and a lot of companies are saying that's a trade violation. So why are they lining up against Google, and what does DoubleClick do?
DoubleClick is an online advertising company, and they specialize in display advertising, which is, you know, the brand banners that you can see.
It's sort of the older model of advertising, when you opened up a website and there was just a banner there and there was nothing to click through, or it's just a billboard online.
Exactly, and it's taking the print and billboard model to the online world, exactly. So Google would have the two most powerful online types of advertising businesses with DoubleClick.
Well, and this is why other companies hate Google, because it becomes their world and you live in it.
Exactly. They're everywhere. They're so dominant. And now if they're going to take over the online advertising world and branch out into other areas, it's just they're getting impossible to even maintain a sort of a follow on. Mm-hmm. Microsoft and Yahoo are really struggling.
Well, and given that, what does it mean that Google is bidding on the government auction for UHF television frequencies? This is where you used to see, you know, as someone wrote, the Green Acres and the Munsters, you know, these really kind of fuzzy TV shows. You needed rabbit ear antennas to bring it in. Why would Google want it?
Google says that they want to make all the world's information accessible and searchable. And that means helping consumers with the conduits to get to that information. That's why they're also doing municipal wireless.
Yeah, places like Philadelphia, just, you know, you can walk
through Mountain View.
Mountain View, California. You can go online with your computer anywhere. It's wireless.
Exactly. And they're trying to really make it easy for people to get online and to get to, you know, the information. With the 700 megahertz spectrum, they've said that they are considering and possibly will bid on that. They might bid on spectrum with a partner, maybe someone who's more, you know, telephony focused.
Telephony meaning telephone?
Telephone, yeah. And they've caused a stir in the industry. People are concerned that now they're going to come into another market and try and dominate that. They want to open it up.
Well, this gets really interesting because, as you're saying, they could possibly use this UHF television frequency for phones. And now, I didn't realize that AT&T and Verizon are billions of dollars in debt, and they are now afraid that they could be knocked out like IBM was after personal computers came around. If Google is able to do as they do with everything else and offer phone service for free, now how might they do that?
They don't want to be a service provider. They want to enable and maybe partner with others who are doing that to provide the services that the consumers would use.
The way I understand it, tell me if I've got this right. Let's say there's a phone that could be used as an open phone. People have learned how to break into the iPhone, so it didn't have to be tied to one specific network. And then Google had this broadband where they could, you know, get information out. They could literally provide a phone service if you already had the phone, and they would pay for it by, every now and then shooting you some advertising on your phone.
Exactly. That's the model that they've been looking at, is to have advertising intermittent, who knows exactly when and how long and what it would look like, that would pay for the service and enable them to offer that.
By the way, what about the rumor you wrote about it yesterday that they might make their own phone, the G phone?
Yeah, there's a lot of misunderstanding. They're not going to get into the hardware business. So for them to make a phone that's going to be a Google-branded phone is not likely. Hmm. They're not talking about this at all. So this is all rumors, reports, and hearsay. But basically, it does seem that there could be something in the works where they would have their services possibly ad-supported on phones that, you know, bundled with Google, maybe even possibly a Google operating system that would enable people to access, as they said, the data in the cloud.
We know Google is thinking of expanding into medical records storage, GPS technology. A lot of libraries are concerned about Google wanting to scan books and be the keeper of book information. So huge expanse. However, there's a downside. As we said, Google has its critics. And also, it seems as if the internal paradise, it might be shakier than some thought. Some former staff have left. What are the concerns about Google?
The concerns and challenges are, can they ride this online advertising wave for a lot longer? What happens if there's an overall recession and people have to cut back on spending? Advertising is one of the first things to go.
So if they're entirely dependent on advertising as opposed to, you know, they don't sell computers or phones.
Exactly. That's such a huge part. 99% of their business is these online ads and mostly search. And so if that takes a hit, they're at a big risk. Although that's been a concern for a couple of years now, you know, we keep waiting, you know, is that going to come?
Right,
and they've been doing well.
At $600 a share and rising. Analysts are still saying, even though their stocks are so expensive, they're still worth buying.
Exactly. Yeah, they're still considered one of the best internet stocks to own. They're also growing at such a rapid pace. They're hiring so many people every day. It's just amazing. This is worldwide. They are expanding in other countries, so that kind of makes sense.
We read that the Nooglers, these are the new Googlers or staffers, they had a staff of a little over 2,000 in 2004, and this past summer it reached 13,000, almost 14,000. And we understand that all of those employees aren't as happy as they once were. The Google world was painted as a paradise where everyone loved their job and the tremendous perks. Now some former staffers are saying the company motto was "Don't be evil," but they're worried that that's changed.
it's hard to retain that excitement and freshness and idealism when you become a $200 billion company.
Do no evil, I think, was the mantra right before they went public.
I think they believe that. I think the founders really would like to retain that and really are trying to follow that. It's just hard. There's conflicts with being a business that's there to make money. I mean, it's part of their problem in China. You know, they have to be there. They want to compete. Yet doing business there means that they're going to violate human rights, and there's a problem.
There's a conflict there.
Yeah.
Well, Google is Eleanor Mills' beat. She covers the company for CNET and has been speaking to us from the CNET studios in San Francisco. And Eleanor, thanks for, you know, bringing us up to date on so many things. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, looking ahead, tomorrow on Here and Now, the admissions game. We're going to speak to a woman who's charging up to $40,000 a child to get that child into a top university. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, have the Red Sox become the Yankees? In fact, will one Yankee in particular become a Red Sox? We'll have an update from a sleepy Red Sox nation after the news, Here and Now. The Supreme Court announced today that it will step into the long-running legal battle over punitive damages stemming from the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill. Today, the High Court agreed to rule on the legality of the $2.5 billion verdict against the corporation, which ExxonMobil claims is the largest damages award ever approved by federal appeals court judges. You may recall that 11 million gallons of oil spilled into Alaska's Prince William Sound 18 years ago when a supertanker ran aground on a reef. Here now, Supreme Court reporter Lyle Denniston joins us. And Lyle, remind us, who are the plaintiffs, and what did they say at trial about Exxon's role in the spill?
What's left of the lawsuit is a group of fishermen and business people who claimed that their property was severely damaged by the oil spill in March 1989, and they have won a verdict of $2.5 billion. At one point, they had won $5 billion, but that was later cut in half. And this is the last round in a series of legal disputes following the incidents. Exxon has already spent a couple of billion on cleanup efforts. It's also paid $150 million to the federal and state governments to clean up the environmental damage that's done, and it's paid off some other fishermen and business people with a $300 million settlement.
Well, let's be clear. Those plaintiffs felt that Exxon Valdez knew that the captain of the ship had a drinking problem and might have been drinking at the time that he ran aground. That was the fault question, but is that question being considered anymore, or is it just the punitive question?
No, the only thing before the Supreme Court now is the punitive question. The pilot of the vessel at the time, Captain Joseph Hazelwood, was later convicted in state court of negligence in spilling the oil. He was not found guilty, however, of operating the ship while he was drunk. But what's left is a claim of ExxonMobil that the $2.5 billion award is excessive for a number of legal reasons, because ultimately Exxon itself was found not to be to blame for intentionally dumping the oil. So this is an unintentional violation of maritime law on which the award was based.
And what's at stake here beyond Exxon's claim?
Well, because the Supreme Court limited to a degree what it's agreeing to rule, one could almost say that this is only a case about punitive damages for such incidents in the maritime, in the shipping industry. But virtually the entire world of shipping has filed briefs in this case, and so it's of major importance to the shipping industry and to environmentalists who are concerned about oil spill. But the larger question of whether or not large punitive damages verdicts are unconstitutional is the part of the case that the Supreme Court today said it would not review. So it's focusing only on the this rather peculiar but ancient field of law involving behavior on the high seas.
Huh. So we know that in February the court set aside a nearly $80 million judgment against Philip Morris. It had been awarded to the widow of a smoker. But that, which some people say points to a court that doesn't like large punitive damages, that is not at play in this decision today to take up this claim.
No, Exxon tried to raise that kind of an issue, too. That is, you know, that constitutionally this verdict was just too high on the numbers. But that's the one part of the case that the court explicitly today refused to hear.
So the Supreme Court is just considering maritime law. And, Lal, what is the thinking given that? Is it possible that ExxonMobil may not pay any of this $2.5 billion fine?
Well, you know, there are two answers to that, Robin. One is that one of its claims is that it doesn't owe any or shouldn't owe any punitive damages award because of the legal rationale here was simply made up by judges, and it conflicts with what Congress wanted in the Clean Water Act.
Mm-hmm.
There's a second issue here of real fascination. That is, Justice Alito has taken himself out of the case because apparently he owns a substantial block of ExxonMobil stock, and so there's the prospect of a 4-4 split in the justices when the decision comes out, and that would result in simply upholding the $2.5 billion verdict. So that's a somewhat unusual twist to this case.
Sure. Lal Denniston reports on the Supreme Court for Here and Now and SCOTUSblog.com. Lal, thanks as always.
Okay. I'm glad to be with you, Robin.
Well, we can finally get to sleep at a reasonable hour.
Papelbon sets. At the belt, the pitch. Swing and a miss! It's over! The Red Sox have swept the Colorado Rockies, and the Boston Red Sox become the first team in the 21st century to win two World Series titles. Can you believe it?
No, frankly. The Red Sox are on their way back here to Boston after that series that seemed over before we'd even found the remote. The Sox sweeping the Colorado Rockies in four games. Could it be that the curse has finally been lifted? What will all those therapists do? Here and Now reporter Kurt Nickisch was in Denver last night. Kurt, what was it like in the locker room after the game?
I think the curse was lifted because you really didn't get the sense of catharsis that there was, you know, 3 years ago when they won the World Series back then for the first time in 86 years.
We talked about the team differences, the Sox with generations of fans, the Rockies just 15 years old. Did it feel different at Coors Field?
Definitely, definitely. Because the fans really never got into it unless they had, you know, cues from the PA system or they'd wait for the team actually to do well before they started cheering. I mean, one endearing thing was the fact that they were actually serving Sam Adams beer at Coors Field. And I just thought to myself, you know, if you really want to jinx your team, if you really want to lose this, you know, keep serving that. And then the other funny thing was they handed out white towels to everybody to, you know, wave as rally towels. But at the end of the series, it really looked like they were just flags of surrender.
And Sam Adams, of course, being a Boston beer. Well, the Rockies' payroll is about $54 million. The Red Sox paid just about that, just for the right to talk to pitcher Daisuke Matsuzaka. And the Sox total payroll was about $143 million. Is the sense that money was the driving force behind this win?
Yes and no. I mean, it was definitely a sore point among some of the Colorado supporters. But the stars really were two rookies, Dustin Pedroia and Jacoby Ellsbury, two people who came up through the farm system. So I think the Sox have done it with money and with a great system.
Well, people are now saying that the Red Sox may be the new Yankees, which is giving all of us pause. But as we know, Yankee slugger Alex Rodriguez is a free agent after opting out of the remaining 3 years of his 10-year, $252 million deal. And the talk is that the Red Sox might pick him up. But would they really not take their third baseman, Mike Lowell, who was the, you know, so dependable and MVP of the series?
A-Rod has got sort of superstar quality. Mike Lowell doesn't have that, but he's just about as team a player as you want to have. And so it's going to be interesting to see who wants to spend what money on whom. But of course, the Red Sox are one of the few teams that would be able to sort of come up with the dollars that A-Rod really commands.
Oh, no, though. We could, you know, if we lose someone like a Mike Lowell, we could start a new curse. Kurt Nickisch speaking to us from Denver, where he witnessed the Boston Red Sox win their second World Series title in 4 years. Kurt, lucky you, and thanks for talking to us.
Oh, but of course.
And Colorado, better luck next year when you should serve Coors beer at Coors Field. Before we go today, Leonard Nimoy, you're listening to Here and Now. fascinating music, and it was composed and performed on a computer by someone with severe physical limitations. Health columnist Judy Foreman is with us. Judy, in your syndicated column today, you profiled Dan Elsey at Tewksbury Hospital here in Massachusetts. Tell everyone, what are his challenges?
Well, he was born with cerebral palsy, and he can't really move in any coordinated way, his arms or his torso. He can move his head, and he certainly communicates with his eyes, but his body, he really can't control that much, except for his head.
And with his head, he can also speak because he can tap out words or point to words on a computer. Now, he had always listened to music, but this music that we're listening to now, he actually composed?
He actually wrote it with a special program called HyperScore that was developed at MIT's Media Lab by Todd Machover. It's an amazing thing. I was really moved to watch him use it.
Well, and by the way, we'll link listeners to a photograph as well. It's just a huge board where he can put in information and, you know, using a computer, he can create this music.
Yes, and what he sees on his screen is a bunch of different colored lines, each one kind of representing an instrument, and he has been able to sort of point with his laser pointer on his forehead to make different music happen at different times. So different instruments come in. It's like an orchestra that he is essentially running.
Well, and we know that you met Dan as part of your research into the question of music therapy and the brain. You talked to several specialists. What is the connection between music and the brain?
It's amazing. I mean, our brains are basically wired to process music, and nobody really knows why. I corresponded with Oliver Sacks, the very famous neurologist who wrote Musicophilia. That's his most recent book. And he said that, you know, it's not clear in evolution which came first, singing or speech, and that a lot of primitive cultures, people use both kind of interchangeably. And the parts of the brain that seem to process music are very deep parts of the brain, as well as the more thinking centers of the brain.
Particularly music that we like. You talk to scientists who said that those chills that you feel when you hear an extraordinary piece of music, they're real. Something's happening in your brain.
That is really cool research. It's from the Montreal Neurological Institute. And they took brain scans of people, PET scans and fMRI scans, while people were listening to music that they liked. And this effect did not show up in music that people didn't like. And it turns out that the parts of the brain, the old reptilian brain, the limbic system, you know, the parts that are purely there for processing sex drives, hunger, thirst, these really basic drives, that's what gets activated by music you really like.
So the brain may consider music on the same level as, you know, having food and water.
Exactly. Right. And why would that be?
Why would that be? That's the question. What does science say about music and, for instance, stroke patients?
Well, yes, using music for therapy is very interesting because it's long been known that people who have a stroke on the left side of their brain, which is where most of us process speech, a lot of those people can't speak after a stroke, but they can sing because a lot of the music processing is on the right side of the brain. So people can learn to sing sort of, I love you, or whatever, when they couldn't say, I love you.
And therapists can use music to treat stroke patients.
Yes, at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, for instance, they are really training people who couldn't speak to sing instead of speak, and then gradually some of them can learn to actually speak.
Well, back to Dan Elsey, who has cerebral palsy and now is composing music. It also seems to, I mean, this would seem so basic, but it seems to give him a new sense of who he is.
It was so, I was really moved to tears talking to him because he, you know, his eyes would light up when you'd ask him what music means to him. And I asked him directly, I said, you know, type out for me what music means for you. And he said, he typed out, I am smart. I mean, he really has good self-esteem. And he wrote, I have a good personality. And then I said, is there anything else you want to tell people that, you know, what music is doing for you? And he typed out, I am a musician.
Syndicated health columnist Judy Foreman, as we listen to more of musician Dan Elsey's music. And for more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Judy, thanks as always.
You're very welcome.
Back with Leonard Nimoy, photographer, in 1 minute, here and now. We all saw the headlines during fashion season. Models ordered not to go below a certain weight after the death of a Brazilian model from anorexia. Well, Leonard Nimoy would be pleased. Yes, that Leonard Nimoy. Let's just acknowledge the Mr. Spock Vulcan thing before we move on, as he has, to fine art photography. Leonard Nimoy studied photography shortly after Star Trek went off the air in 1969, and he's been showing his work ever since. His latest project, Nude Women, often in poses evoking iconic paintings or fashion photos, but in Nimoy's work, they are proudly obese. The collection, called The Full Body Project, is on view at the R. Michelson Gallery in Northampton, Massachusetts. A book is due out in November, but to see some of the photos now, you can go to our website, here-now.org. And Leonard Nimoy joins us from the studios of NPR West. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Who are these women that you photographed?
It began with a lady who approached me after I was presenting some earlier work at a seminar, and she said, I'm a model, I'm of a different body type than what you've been photographing, will you be interested in working with me? Mm-hmm. And it was in Northern California. We have a home up there in Lake Tahoe and a studio there, and we photographed her in that studio, a very large lady.
Oh, I understand, 250 pounds.
At least, yep. Yeah. I'm not good at counting those numbers, but I think at least. And whenever I showed those images of that lady, along with other work, she got all the attention. People were so curious about who is she and how did you come to photograph her. And the work looked like sculpture. I photographed her in black and white, and her body looked like marble sculpture. So I began to research body size. And it led me to a group of women in San Francisco who called themselves the Fat Bottom Review. They are burlesque performers, you know, wonderful people, all of them large ladies. I photographed them twice, once in Northern California and in San Francisco, and once at the Hammer Museum in Los Angeles.
Well, I'm looking at pictures that I have in front of me from the Big Burlesque Fat Bottom Review, as photographed by you, Leonard Nimoy. Rolls and rolls of body,
right.
Rolls of fat.
There's no hiding with these women.
I mean,
they're very comfortable in their bodies. I think they express a joie de vivre that is a pleasure to look at. And I'm very pleased with the response to the photographs. It's been very positive.
Well, there's another angle, too, I'm sure you're also hearing about. I, for instance, showed this to a friend whose line of work is health and fitness, and he looked at them and he said, I'm so sorry, but what I see is morbidly
uh-huh.
fat.
You know, I'm not making a case for body size. What I'm presenting is some women who are comfortable in their bodies as opposed to so many millions of women who are not. And I believe that there's something to be said about what the advertising people have told the women in our culture. And that is that if you don't look like the models who are showing the clothes, you need help. And we can sell it to you. We can sell it in the form of pills, diets, in the form of surgery. There's a gigantic industry built around telling women that they can attain a better look and be happier with their look if they make this financial and physical investment. And I think for so many women, it's simply unattainable. I'm told that the average American woman weighs 25% more than the women who are modeling the clothes that they're being sold.
Well, there's social statement here, but also art. You are a photographer. And,
right.
You know, I'm looking at one of the pictures. There's one of a woman lying on her side. She's got a black wrap sort of around her head and her
yeah.
bottom, her feet. And so you just see the trunk of her body. And it does,
right.
If you sort of squint your eyes, it looks a little bit like, oh, beautiful, soft, rolling hills in Idaho. Yeah. And we think of the Colombian artist Fernando Botero or Rubens, his work. You know, this idea of almost an overblown, grotesque, almost image of women.
Uh-huh.
To you, is it, what is it? Is it beauty?
Beauty is culture driven. In some cultures, these women would be considered very beautiful. And in fact, in some cultures, it would be assumed that they come from a very affluent home because their husbands can afford to feed them well.
Yeah.
Women in our culture are most congratulated for losing weight. My gosh, you look wonderful. Have you lost weight? How many times have you heard that?
You deliberately posed many of the models to mimic iconic photos, like the famous photo that Herb Ritz took of Naomi Campbell, Linda Evangelista, Cindy Crawford, you know, the supermodels.
Right.
Well, what are some of the other poses that I'm seeing here?
There's a photograph which is a comment on Matisse's Le Danse, of the dancers dancing in a circle. So I have these women in that pose.
Let's describe that pose, because that's the one that people might conjure up an image in their mind. There's one woman flinging her arm backwards in joy, and
It is exactly as you described. It's a circle of women dancing. They're nude, and they reflect the image that was done by Matisse in the late 1800s, a very famous painting.
Leonard Nimoy, this is not the first time you've published photographs that someone might consider controversial. Your 2002 book, Shekinah, have I said that correctly?
Shekinah, yes.
Inspired by mystical Judaism, and your images of God's female aspect on earth, it was controversial to some Jewish groups.
Yes.
Is it about provoking your work?
Oh, no. The work takes me where it takes me. I say in the book that I was told many, many years ago by a very wonderful museum director and curator named Marcia Tucker, who said to me, do what scares you. And I have found that it's a great mantra for an artist to try unexplored territory. I cannot predict what the audience reaction is going to be. In this case, I understand the comment that you referred to earlier by someone, I suppose, who's a medical person. Mm-hmm. But in this case, I'm amazed at how many people respond to it so positively. And they say these women express beauty and joy. I had no idea what to anticipate. I didn't intentionally reach out for controversy. But there is at least animated discussion about these images. And I'm very proud of the book. I think it's going to create some very interesting conversation.
Did you have any kind of rejiggering of your own stereotypes?
My hope is that any time I do a piece of work in any of the art forms, whether it's playing Spock in Star Trek or shooting these photographs, my life has changed as a result. I learned something. I'm affected by it. The woman who formed this group, the Fat Bottom Review, Heather McAllister, who unfortunately has passed away. She was a cancer patient. But she told me when we were discussing the nature of her work, she was an anthropologist. And I asked her, what are you doing with your anthropology degree? And she said, I'm doing this. This work, this Fat Bottom Review. And what she said was, anytime a fat person gets on a stage to perform and is not the butt of a joke, that's a political statement.
Well, I can't go back to the office. There are certain members of the staff who are waiting to hear the answer to this last question, so I hope you don't mind.
Name those people. Who are they?
Kevin and Emiko want to know, are you going to be in the new Star Trek prequel that's being filmed?
I am.
Oh, any plot lines we can dangle?
Well, I can tell you this. This is a newsy tidbit. When I finish this conversation with you, I'm going to Paramount Studios for the first on-camera testing of my makeup and wardrobe. This is a very current issue.
Extremely exciting. Will the ears be there and the salute?
Yes, I'm looking forward to it. The film is being made by a very talented young filmmaker named J.J. Abrams. I'm excited to be working with him. I think he has a very strong feeling about Star Trek and a concept for this movie. And in the meantime, I will be in Massachusetts. I'll be there for the seminars in connection with the Full Body Project.
Excellent. So can you give us just a taste of what happens to Spock?
Yes. It's a prequel, but I'm in another timeline. So I can tell you that Spock in this movie is 175 years old.
Oh, okay.
I hear you
even in the prequel, if you're 175 in the prequel and it takes 7 years to consummate a Vulcan marriage, at 175, how many divorces have you had?
Oh, we don't talk about that publicly. Vulcans do enjoy some degree of privacy, you know.
That's right. They're very discreet.
But
to the matter at hand, Leonard Nimoy's The Full Body Project is on view at the R. Michelson Gallery in Northampton, Massachusetts. For information about the accompanying book and to see some of the images, go to our website, here-now.org. Leonard, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Robin. Thank you.
And this quick note, this past weekend, William Shatner announced he will not be in the new Star Trek movie. Or as he put it, Spock, but no Captain Kirk? Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.